My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Imagine a town square in the 17th century. The air is thick with the smell of mud and smoke, and a crowd has gathered, not for a market day, but for a spectacle. In the center of the square stands a wooden platform with a pillory, a device with holes for a person's head and hands. A man is locked into it, unable to move, his face exposed to the jeering crowd. For the crime of petty theft, he will spend the day here, subjected to public ridicule. People will throw rotten vegetables and insults, his punishment not being locked away, but being shamed in front of everyone he knows. In another part of the world, a ship is being loaded with human cargo. These aren't enslaved people, but convicts, being banished from their home country forever, sent to a distant, unknown land as a punishment for their crimes. There is no sentence to serve. Their punishment is permanent exile. Now picture a massive stone building with high walls and endless rows of small, identical cells. Inside, there is silence. People are locked away from the world, their days governed by the ringing of bells and the watchful eyes of guards. Their punishment is not a whip or a public spectacle, but the loss of time itself, a period of their life erased from the outside world. This is the modern prison. How did we get from the pillory and the exile ship to the sprawling correctional facilities of today? How did society decide that the best way to deal with crime was not to inflict pain or shame on the body, but to confine the person, to take away their freedom and lock them in a box? The journey from one to the other wasn't a simple change. It was a revolution in how we think about crime, punishment, and what it means to be human. Welcome back to How Does That Work? In today's episode, we're unlocking the history of the modern prison. We're going to travel back to a time when punishment was a brutal public display and discover the radical ideas that changed everything. We'll explore the birth of a new kind of building, the penitentiary, and the two competing American systems that would shape the future of incarceration around the world. From the Quaker belief that silence could lead to salvation to the modern-day challenges of overcrowding and reform, this is the story of how the prison came to be. Before the idea of locking someone up for years even existed, punishment looked very different. For most of human history, justice was swift, public, and focused on the body. If you committed a crime, you weren't given a sentence in the way we think of it today. Instead, society would inflict a direct penalty, often as a public performance meant to deter others. Minor crimes were typically punished with public humiliation. This could mean being locked in the stocks or a pillory in the town square, where you would be a target for public scorn and ridicule for a day. For more serious offenses, the punishments were brutal and physical. Flogging, branding with a hot iron, or even maiming, like the cutting off of a hand for theft, were common practices. The pain and the permanent mark left on the body were the punishment. For the most serious crimes, the penalty was often death, carried out in public executions that served as grim warnings. But there was another option for dealing with criminals that didn't involve physical harm or death, getting rid of them entirely. Banishment, or transportation, became a popular solution, especially in England. Instead of executing thousands of thieves and debtors, the British Crown began shipping them off to distant colonies. First, they were sent to America, and after the American Revolution, they were transported on a grueling, months-long sea voyage to the new penal colony in Australia. The punishment wasn't a specific number of years. It was the permanent loss of your home, your family, and your life as you knew it. In all of these cases, shame, pain, death, or exile, the idea of a long-term state-run institution for holding and reforming criminals simply didn't exist. Jails were used, but they were just temporary holding pens, places to keep someone before their trial or before their real punishment was carried out. This policy of banishment, known as penal transportation, became the cornerstone of the British justice system for nearly a century. In the late 1700s, Britain was in the midst of massive social upheaval. The Industrial Revolution was driving people from the countryside into overcrowded, squalid cities, where poverty and crime were rampant. The jails were overflowing. Britain's preferred solution had been to ship convicts to its American colonies. But after the American Revolution, that was no longer an option. The solution was a new, impossibly distant land that had just been charted by Captain James Cook, Australia. The plan was brutally simple: empty the nation's prisons and establish a new British colony on the far side of the world using forced labor. While we might imagine these transport ships filled with the most dangerous murderers and violent criminals, the reality is that the vast majority of the people transported were convicted of petty crimes. Britain at the time operated under a harsh set of laws known as the Bloody Code, which listed over 200 offences, many of them minor property crimes, as being punishable by death. Stealing a loaf of bread, a handkerchief, or a sheep could get you sent to the gallows. In this context, a sentence of transportation for 7 years, 14 years, or life to Australia was often presented as a merciful alternative to execution. As a result, the convict fleets were filled with the desperate poor, servants who had stolen from their masters, starving farmers, and children who had picked a pocket. They were joined by a smaller number of political prisoners, most notably Irish rebels who had fought against British rule. The journey itself was the first part of the punishment. For the convicts, the transport ships were nothing more than floating prisons, and the voyage was an 8-month nightmare. Men, women, and sometimes children were herded below deck and often kept in chains in dark, cramped, and foul-smelling quarters. They were packed in so tightly that they could barely move, sleeping on shared wooden bunks, crawling with lice and vermin. Disease was rampant. Outbreaks of typhus, dysentery, and scurvy were common and could wipe out a significant portion of a ship's human cargo. Rations were meager, the water was often foul, and discipline was maintained with the whip. The death rate on the early fleets was horrifically high, with as many as 1 in 10 convicts dying before they ever saw land. Upon arrival, the convicts became the backbone of the new colony. They were not kept in a single massive prison, but were put to work as a vast enslaved labor force. Male convicts were assigned to government work gangs, clearing dense forests, building roads, quarrying stone, and constructing the first buildings of settlements like Sydney. Female convicts were typically assigned as domestic servants to military officers and the few free settlers. While life was incredibly hard and discipline was brutal, it was not necessarily a life sentence of hard labor. A system of rewards existed, and convicts who were well-behaved could earn a ticket of leave, which allowed them to work for their own wages and live independently within a specific district. Many eventually earned pardons, and having no way to return to Britain, became the first generation of free Australian settlers. Over the course of 80 years, from the arrival of the First Fleet in 1788 until the practice finally ended in 1868, Great Britain transported more than 160,000 convicts to Australia. This massive forced migration was the foundational event of the modern nation. Today, it's estimated that about 20% of the Australian population has convict ancestry, a heritage that has transformed from a source of shame into a point of national pride. The end of transportation came as the Australian colonies grew and began to reject being used as a dumping ground for Britain's criminal class. At the same time, reformers back in England were championing a new, supposedly more enlightened solution to the problem of crime. The land-based, purpose-built penitentiary, which they believed could truly reform the criminal soul. Before we explore how the modern prison for criminals was born, it's important to understand one of the most common reasons a person could be locked up in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Not for committing a crime, but for the simple civil offence of being unable to pay a debt. This was the age of the debtor's prison, an institution that operated on a logic that seems bizarre and cruel to us today. The idea was that a creditor, the person who was owed money, could petition a court to have their debtor arrested and imprisoned. This wasn't a punishment from the state, it was a tool of coercion, a way to hold a person hostage until they, their family or their friends, could scrape together the money to settle the debt. This practice ensnared a huge cross-section of society. While we might picture only the very poor, people from all social classes could find themselves locked away for debt, from shopkeepers whose businesses failed to aristocrats who had gambled away their fortunes. Once inside, the debtor was trapped in a terrible paradox. How could you possibly earn money to pay your debt while you were locked in a cell? The result was that many people were imprisoned for years, sometimes for the rest of their lives, over sums that were often surprisingly small. The system was not designed to solve the problem of debt, but merely to warehouse the indebted. Life inside a debtor's prison was a strange and often brutal world, starkly divided by class. These were not typically state-funded institutions in the modern sense. Instead, they often operated on a pay-to-stay model. Wealthy debtors could afford to rent private rooms, buy their own food and wine, and even have their families come and live with them within the prison walls. For the poor, however, the experience was a nightmare. They were crammed into filthy, overcrowded communal wards known as the common side, where disease and starvation were rampant. Inmates on the common side were often not fed at all and had to depend on begging for scraps from wealthier prisoners or pleading for charity from people on the street through a grate in the prison wall. These institutions left a deep scar on society and culture. The most famous debtors' prison was the Marshalsea in London, which was immortalized by the author Charles Dickens in his novel Little Dorrit. This was not academic for Dickens. He wrote from painful experience, as his own father had been imprisoned in the Marshalsea for debt when Charles was just a boy, a traumatic event that shaped his entire life and worldview. In America, the practice was also widespread, and the experience of either being imprisoned for debt or living in fear of it was common. In fact, two signatories of the Declaration of Independence, Robert Morris and James Wilson, later spent time in debtors' prison. The eventual abolition of debtors' prisons was one of the great social reforms of the 19th century, driven by the same Enlightenment thinking that was creating the new penitentiaries. Reformers argued that the practice was not only cruel, but economically senseless, as it removed productive people from the workforce and guaranteed they could never pay back what they owed. Starting in the 1830s, the United States began passing federal laws to ban the practice, and most Western nations followed suit. While the formal debtor's prison is a thing of the past, its shadow remains. Even today, critics point to modern practices, like jailing people for their inability to pay court fines or child support, as a disturbing echo of this forgotten yet crucial precursor to the modern prison system. Then, in the 18th century, a powerful wave of new ideas swept across Europe, an era we now call the Enlightenment. Thinkers and philosophers began to question the absolute power of kings and the church, and for the first time, they applied reason and science to the problems of society. This included a radical rethinking of crime and punishment. An Italian philosopher named Cesare Beccaria published a hugely influential book called On Crimes and Punishments in 1764. Beccaria argued that punishment should not be about revenge or inflicting pain. Instead, he said it should be rational, proportional to the crime, and aimed at preventing future crimes. He condemned torture and the death penalty, arguing that the certainty of a punishment, not its severity, was the most effective deterrent. Around the same time, an English sheriff named John Howard was horrified by what he saw in the jails of his time. These weren't places of justice. They were disgusting, disease-ridden pits where men, women, and children were all thrown together, often starving while they waited for their trial. Howard traveled all over Europe, documenting the terrible conditions of these jails, and he came back with a revolutionary proposal. He argued for the creation of new kinds of institutions, places that would be clean, orderly, and designed not just to hold people, but to change them. He believed that through hard work, religious instruction, and reflection, a criminal could be reformed and turned into a productive member of society. These ideas, that punishment should be rational, and that it could be used to reform the soul, laid the philosophical foundation for a brand new invention, the penitentiary. The goal wasn't just to punish, but to inspire penitence, or true regret, in the heart of the criminal. This new idea took its most powerful hold in the young and idealistic United States. In Philadelphia, a group of influential thinkers, many of them Quakers, took the ideas of the Enlightenment to heart. They believed that all people had an inner light, and that even the most hardened criminal could be redeemed if they were just given the chance to quietly reflect on their sins. In 1790, they convinced the city to build a new kind of prison wing, the Walnut Street Jail. It featured a block of small, solitary cells where individual inmates would be kept in complete isolation, with only a Bible to read. The theory was that if you removed all the corrupting influences of the outside world, the criminal would be forced to look inward, confront their own conscience, and become penitent. This experiment at Walnut Street Jail was the seed that grew into the world's first true supermax prison, the Eastern State Penitentiary, which opened in 1829. This was a building unlike any other on Earth. It was designed like a giant wagon wheel, with long cell blocks radiating out from a central hub, allowing a single guard to watch all the hallways at once. Each prisoner lived in a small stone cell with a high ceiling and a single skylight, known as the Eye of God, which was their only source of light. They were kept in solitary confinement for their entire sentence. They ate alone in their cells, they exercised alone in a small private yard attached to their cell, and whenever they were moved, a thick hood was placed over their head to ensure they never saw another inmate's face. This system, known as the Pennsylvania system, was built on the belief that total isolation and silence were the keys to rehabilitation. It was an incredibly expensive system to run, as each inmate required their own cell and yard. But it was celebrated around the world as the most humane and forward-thinking form of punishment ever devised. The architectural genius behind Eastern State Penitentiary did not come from a vacuum. It was the most famous real-world application of a powerful and haunting concept dreamed up decades earlier by the English Enlightenment philosopher Jeremy Bentham, the Panopticon. The name itself comes from Greek, meaning all-seeing, and that is exactly what it was designed to be. Bentham envisioned a new kind of institutional building, for prisons, but also for hospitals, schools, or factories, that would operate on the principle of total, constant surveillance. It was a machine for reshaping the human mind through the power of observation. The design itself was as simple as it was ingenious. The Panopticon was a circular building with a ring of cells along the outer wall. Each cell would have two windows, a large one on the outside wall to let in light, and another on the inside wall, facing the center of the circle. At the very center of this ring of cells would stand a tall inspection tower. The guard would sit in this central tower, but the tower itself would be fitted with blinds or dark passages, making it impossible for the inmates in the cells to see into it. The result? The guard in the tower could, at any moment, be looking directly into any given cell, but the inmate would never know if or when they were being watched. The true power of the Panopticon was not physical, but psychological. The goal was to make the prisoners regulate their own behavior. Because they could be under observation at any time, they would be forced to act as if they were always under observation. The constant uncertainty was the key. Over time, Bentham theorized, the inmate would internalize the gaze of the unseen guard, becoming their own disciplinarian. It was a system where the punishment moved from the body, the lash of a whip or the confinement of chains, to the mind itself. The soul would become its own prison. In Bentham's view, this was a more humane and far more efficient way to reform an individual, using the mind's own power to correct its flaws. While very few perfect panopticons were ever built exactly to Bentham's specifications, his idea was tremendously influential. It fundamentally shaped the architecture of control for the next century. The hub-and-spoke design of Eastern State Penitentiary, with its long cell blocks radiating from a central rotunda, is a direct tribute to this concept. It allowed a small number of guards to stand in one spot and survey the entrance to every single cell block, creating that same sense of an all-seeing centralized power. This principle of maximizing observation with minimal staff became a cornerstone of prison design for decades to come. The idea of the Panopticon is so powerful that it has broken out of the history of prisons and is still discussed today. Later philosophers like Michel Foucault used it as a metaphor for how power operates in modern society, arguing that we are all living in a kind of social panopticon, constantly policed by unseen social norms and expectations. In an age of CCTV cameras on every street corner, corporate monitoring of employees, and the constant tracking of our digital lives, Bentham's 18th century vision of an all-seeing eye has become more relevant and unsettling than he could have ever imagined. So far, the entire story of the prison, from the architectural theories to the daily routines of silence and labor, was a story designed by men, for men. For most of the 19th century, female prisoners were largely an afterthought, a small and inconvenient fraction of the incarcerated population. In the new, massive penitentiaries, women were typically warehoused in whatever space was available, a cramped attic, a damp basement, or a single isolated corridor of the men's prison. There was little to no separation based on age or the severity of a crime, and programs for work or education were non-existent. Worst of all, these female wards were almost always overseen by male guards, which led to rampant and systemic sexual abuse and exploitation. The push to change this came not from male prison wardens, but from a powerful social reform movement led by middle and upper-class women, such as the Quaker activist Elizabeth Fry in England. These reformers were horrified by the squalor and abuse they witnessed. Their advocacy, however, was shaped by the paternalistic views of the Victorian era. They saw female criminals not as equals to their male counterparts, but as fallen women who had strayed from their natural roles as mothers and homemakers. The goal of a women's prison, therefore, should not be the same as a man's. It should be to restore these women to their proper domestic sphere through moral and religious guidance. This philosophy led to the creation of a completely new type of institution, the Women's Reformatory. The first of these opened in Indiana in 1873, and its design was a radical departure from the massive fortress-like prisons being built for men. Instead of a single intimidating block of cells, many reformatories were built on a cottage plan. They looked more like a college campus or a country estate, with a series of smaller, separate buildings or cottages scattered across a pleasant green landscape. Each cottage housed a small group of women and was designed to feel like a home, with a shared kitchen, dining room, and living areas. The idea was to create a gentle, domestic environment that would be the first step in re-feminizing the inmates. Life inside the reformatory was centered on this mission of domestic rehabilitation. The two most revolutionary changes were that the institutions were run entirely by female staff, a female superintendent, female doctors, and all female guards, which dramatically reduced the threat of sexual abuse, and the daily schedule was built around learning domestic skills. The primary work for inmates was cooking, cleaning, sewing, and doing laundry. The belief was that by training these fallen women to be excellent housekeepers, wives, and mothers, their criminality could be cured, and they could be successfully returned to society to lead quiet domestic lives. While a vast improvement over the violent neglect of the past, this model was also deeply limiting, reinforcing rigid gender roles and offering little in the way of academic education or skills for financial independence. In the 20th century, especially during the tough-on-crime era, the reformatory model began to fade. As the female prison population grew, many women's facilities were built or managed with the same high-security, punishment-focused approach as men's prisons, losing their unique architectural and philosophical focus. Today, the legacy of this history is a system still struggling to address the unique needs of female inmates. An overwhelming majority of incarcerated women are mothers, many of them single parents. A high percentage are survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse, bringing deep trauma with them into a system that is often ill-equipped to help them heal. These realities, from pregnancy behind bars to the psychological toll of being separated from children, highlight the ongoing challenges within a prison system that was, from its very first day, imagined as a place for men. While the Pennsylvania system was gaining international fame, a rival model was emerging in New York that would ultimately prove far more influential. At the Auburn State Prison, officials developed a different approach to the problem of punishment. They agreed with the Quakers that prisoners should be isolated at night to reflect on their sins. But they found that keeping inmates in solitary confinement 24 hours a day was not only incredibly expensive, but also mentally destructive, leading to high rates of insanity and suicide. The solution was a new hybrid system. Prisoners would sleep in small individual cells at night, but during the day, they would work together in large silent workshops. This became known as the Auburn system, or the congregate system. The key was absolute silence. Inmates marched in lockstep from their cells to the workshops, their heads bowed. They worked side by side all day, but they were forbidden to speak, gesture, or even make eye contact with one another. The silence was enforced by guards who would not hesitate to use the whip for any violation. This model had two major advantages over the Pennsylvania system. First, it was much cheaper. The cells could be built smaller since they were only for sleeping, and stacking them in multi-tiered cell blocks was far more space efficient. Second, and most importantly, the congregate workshops could be turned into profitable factories. Prison administrators signed contracts with outside businesses to use inmate labor to produce goods like furniture, shoes, and tools. The prison, therefore, could pay for itself and even turn a profit for the state. This economic appeal was irresistible, and the Auburn model quickly became the dominant design for prisons across the United States and eventually the world. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, the Auburn model spread. As the Auburn model spread, it led to the creation of massive, fortress-like prisons across the country. And no prison captured the public imagination or represented the peak of this punitive, security-obsessed era more than Alcatraz. Opening as a federal penitentiary in 1934, The Rock was not a normal prison. It was a symbol created during the high-profile Public Enemy era of gangsters like Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly. Alcatraz was designed to be the final stop, the end of the line for the most disruptive, violent, and escape-prone inmates in the entire federal system. A prisoner wasn't sentenced directly to Alcatraz. They had to earn their way there by causing trouble at other prisons. Its purpose was simple: to be a place so rigid, so monotonous, and so inescapable that it could break the will of any man sent there. The prison's power began with its geography. It sat on a rugged 22-acre rock in the middle of the San Francisco Bay, surrounded on all sides by more than a mile of freezing, treacherous water with dangerously strong currents. But the man-made security was just as formidable. The old military prison on the island was completely rebuilt with tool-proof steel bars, and the main cell house was a prison within a prison, a cage of concrete and steel isolated from the outer walls. The dining hall was equipped with tear gas canisters in the ceiling that could be remotely detonated. There were 13 official headcounts every single day, and the guard-to-inmate ratio was roughly 1-3, far higher than any other prison. This was all designed to create a suffocating sense of psychological control, constantly reminding the inmates that resistance was futile and escape was impossible. Life on the Rock was a masterclass in monotony. For the first several years of its operation, a strict rule of silence was enforced at nearly all times. Unlike other prisons, basic rights were reframed as privileges. Inmates had to earn the right to work, to receive letters from family, to have visitors, or even to play softball in the yard. Any infraction could strip those privileges away, returning an inmate to a state of absolute deprivation. Yet, despite its brutal reputation, it had some features that inmates ironically preferred. The food was known to be the best in the federal system, a strategy to prevent riots, and every man had his own cell, a welcome privacy compared to the violent, overcrowded dormitories of other prisons. This was the world of America's most famous criminals, including Al Capone, Machine Gun Kelly, and the Birdman Robert Stroud. For 29 years, the legend of Alcatraz held, no one had ever successfully escaped. There were 14 known attempts involving 36 men, but all were either caught, shot, or presumed drowned in the icy bay. That is, until the night of June 11, 1962. After months of meticulous planning, three inmates, Frank Morris and brothers John and Clarence Anglin, pulled off the most famous prison break in American history. Using sharpened spoons and a drill made from a stolen vacuum cleaner motor, they had painstakingly chipped away at the crumbling concrete walls around the air vents in their cells. They concealed their work with cleverly painted cardboard grills. On the night of the escape, they placed realistic dummy heads made from soap, toilet paper, and real human hair from the prison barbershop in their beds to fool the guards making their rounds. They slipped through the vents, climbed to the roof, and disappeared into the night on a makeshift raft made from over 50 stolen raincoats. The three men were never seen again. The official FBI investigation concluded that they surely drowned in the bay's powerful currents, but no bodies were ever definitively recovered. The Great Escape became an enduring mystery, a crack in the fortress's perfect facade. But it wasn't the escape that closed Alcatraz. The prison was shut down just a year later, in 1963, for a much more mundane reason. It was simply too expensive to operate. The salty sea air had badly corroded the buildings, and a renovation would have cost a fortune. Alcatraz's legacy was sealed. It was never a model for other prisons to follow. It was a one-of-a-kind super prison, the ultimate symbol of the Big House era, a place designed to be the perfect cage, whose legend in the end was defined by the three men who may have managed to fly free. The original Enlightenment ideal of a penitentiary for quiet reflection and reform began to fade, replaced by a focus on security, discipline, and industrial production. The goal was less about saving the inmate's soul and more about controlling their body and using their labor. This era saw the rise of the prison industrial complex in its earliest form, where the punishment of criminals was directly linked to economic output. While the Auburn model's factory prisons were taking shape in the north, the idea of using inmate labor took a much darker and more brutal turn in the American South after the Civil War. With the abolition of slavery, the southern economy was in ruins, and the wealthy planter class had lost its source of free labor. They found a solution in a loophole in the 13th Amendment, which banned slavery and involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime. This clause became the legal foundation for the convict lease system, a practice that has been accurately described as slavery by another name. Here's how it worked. Southern states began aggressively arresting newly freed African Americans using a series of discriminatory laws known as Black Codes. These laws criminalized minor or fabricated offenses like vagrancy, loitering, changing employers without permission, or even speaking loudly in the presence of white women. Thousands of black men were then funneled through a biased court system and given long sentences. Because the war-torn states had no money to build new Auburn-style prisons, they instead leased these convicts out to the highest bidder. Private corporations, coal mining companies, railroad builders, plantation owners, and lumber camps would pay the state a fee in exchange for a workforce they could exploit with absolute impunity. The state made a profit, the companies got labor that was even cheaper than slavery, and the convicts were thrown into a system of unimaginable horror. The conditions for leased convicts were often far worse than those under slavery. A slave owner had a long-term financial interest in keeping an enslaved person alive, as they were considered valuable property. A corporation leasing a convict, however, had no such incentive. The convicts were a disposable, replaceable resource, leased for a short time and easily replaced with another body from the courts. They were worked from sunup to sundown in deadly conditions, often deep in coal mines with no ventilation or in malaria-ridden swamps building railways. They were housed in crude, overcrowded barracks, given starvation-level rations, and subjected to constant extreme violence from whips and torture devices. The death rates were astronomical. In some convict lease camps in states like Alabama and Mississippi, as many as one in four prisoners died every single year from overwork, malnutrition, or abuse. This system was more than just a labor program. It was a powerful tool of social and racial control. It effectively criminalized black life and provided a legal mechanism to force African Americans back into a state of bondage, suppressing their economic and political aspirations in the era of Jim Crow. It also had a devastating long-term effect on the Southern economy. By providing a constant supply of ultra-cheap, coerced labor, the convict lease system disincentivized industries from innovating or investing in new technology. Why buy a new steam shovel when you could lease 100 men for pennies and work them to death? The convict lease system flourished for decades, generating huge profits for both state governments and private industry. It finally began to decline in the early 20th century, not primarily out of a moral awakening, but due to a combination of factors. Muckraking journalists began to expose the horrific conditions, creating public outrage. At the same time, some business leaders argued that the system's sheer brutality and inefficiency were making the South a backward and unattractive place for modern investment. Slowly, states began to phase out the leasing of convicts to private companies, but the exploitation didn't end. Instead, it evolved as many states purchased their own plantations and created massive state-run prison farms, like the infamous Parchman Farm in Mississippi, where the brutal logic of forced agricultural labor continued for decades more. As the old Big House prisons grew larger and more crowded in the mid-20th century, their internal social structure began to change in a way that administrators were completely unprepared for. For most of prison history, the primary conflict was a straightforward one, the inmates versus the guards. But starting in the 1950s and 60s, particularly in the sprawling prison systems of California and Texas, a new and far more complex power structure emerged from within the inmate population itself, the modern prison gang. This was a fundamental shift that would permanently alter the nature of life, violence, and power behind bars. The rise of these gangs was not random. It was a direct response to the prison environment. A major catalyst was the court-ordered racial desegregation of prisons. While a progressive step on paper, in the violent and scarcity-driven world of a maximum security prison, it threw different racial groups into direct and often hostile competition for resources, status, and safety. In response, inmates began to organize for collective protection. The first major gangs, like the Mexican Mafia and the Aryan Brotherhood, formed along strict racial and ethnic lines. Joining a gang was a matter of survival. It provided a shield against predators, a support network, and a sense of identity in a world designed to strip it away. These were not just loose cliques, they were highly sophisticated organizations with rigid hierarchies, written constitutions, and lifelong commitments. Membership was often sealed with a vow of blood in, blood out, meaning the only way to leave the gang was to die. Leaders, often serving life sentences in solitary confinement, could communicate complex orders to their subordinates through coded messages, secret symbols, and even corrupt staff. They established control over the prison's vast underground economy, running sophisticated networks for smuggling drugs, tobacco, and other contraband. These gangs created a parallel power structure that operated right under the noses of the official administration. The emergence of these powerful gangs made prisons exponentially more dangerous. It was no longer just about individual disputes. A fight between two inmates could now trigger a full-scale war between two gangs, leading to coordinated multi-person attacks and large-scale riots. This presented a massive challenge for prison administrators, who found their authority completely undermined. In many prisons, the gangs became the de facto government of the cell blocks, enforcing their own rules and their own brutal form of justice. This led to a dangerous dilemma for wardens. Either wage a constant bloody war against the gangs for control, or engage in a quiet, unofficial strategy of ruling through the gangs, where they would negotiate with gang leaders to maintain a fragile peace in the prison yard. Crucially, the power of these gangs did not stay confined behind prison walls. They began to project their influence into the outside world, using members who were paroled or released to run their street-level operations, including drug trafficking, extortion, and targeted assassinations. The prison transformed into a recruitment center and a command hub for vast criminal enterprises. This created a destructive, self-perpetuating cycle. Gang activity on the streets would lead to more arrests, which in turn would strengthen the gang's numbers and power inside the prison. This evolution cemented the role of the prison gang as a permanent and powerful force, not just in the life of the prison, but in the landscape of organized crime across the entire country. By the mid-20th century, a new philosophy began to take hold, known as the medical model. This approach viewed criminal behavior not as a sin to be repented, but as an illness to be diagnosed and treated. Prisons were rebranded as correctional facilities, and new programs were introduced, including psychological counseling, vocational training, and academic education. The focus shifted, at least in theory, back towards rehabilitation. However, this ideal was short-lived. By the 1970s, a growing sense that these rehabilitative programs were failing, combined with rising crime rates, led to a dramatic political shift. The public mood turned against the idea of treating criminals and demanded a return to punishment. When the promise of rehabilitation crumbles, what is left is often just neglect and brutality. Throughout history, the boiling point is sometimes reached in a violent explosion that rips the facade off a prison and exposes the rot within. Far from being random acts of chaos, major prison riots are often highly organized protests against inhumane conditions, and no event illustrates this more powerfully than the 1971 Attica prison uprising in upstate New York, a tragedy that would become a major turning point in the history of the American prison. By the fall of 1971, Attica was a powder keg waiting to ignite. It was severely overcrowded, holding over 2,200 men in a facility built for 1,600. The inmates, who were 54% black and 9% Puerto Rican, were overseen by an exclusively white and rural staff of guards, creating a massive racial and cultural chasm. Prisoners were allotted one roll of toilet paper a month, were lucky if they could shower once a week, and were paid pennies for their labor. Their letters were heavily censored, their access to education was minimal, and their complaints of guard brutality were systematically ignored. The correctional facility was failing to correct. It was simply warehousing and degrading men. On September 9, 1971, a minor incident quickly escalated, and within hours, about 1,300 inmates had seized control of the prison's D yard, taking 42 staff members hostage. What happened next was not chaos, but the creation of a temporary society. The inmates in D yard, with remarkable speed, elected leaders, set up security patrols to protect the hostages, and established a negotiating committee. They invited journalists and neutral observers inside to see the conditions for themselves. They then issued a list of practical proposals for reform. They weren't demanding freedom, they were demanding dignity. Their list included things like better food, adequate medical treatment, an end to male censorship, the right to religious freedom, and most importantly, an end to the routine physical abuse by guards. For four tense days, the world watched as these men, who society had deemed animals, articulated a clear and rational vision for a more humane system. The standoff ended in bloodshed. Governor Nelson Rockefeller, refusing the inmates' pleas for him to come and negotiate in person, declared that the state would not bow to their demands. On the morning of September 13th, he ordered state troopers to retake the prison by force. Helicopters flew over the yard, dropping thick clouds of tear gas to disorient the crowd below. Then, hundreds of troopers stormed in with guns blazing, firing indiscriminately into the haze for several minutes. When the shooting stopped, 29 inmates and 10 of the hostages were dead. In the immediate aftermath, prison officials falsely told the media that the inmates had slit the hostages' throats. Autopsies soon revealed the truth. Every single hostage had been killed by the bullets of the state troopers. Attica became a symbol of a broken system. The shocking violence, broadcast on national television, shattered what was left of the public's belief in the idea of a correctional facility. The uprising and its brutal suppression exposed the deep veins of racism, neglect, and violence that ran through the American prison system. In the short term, it led to some modest reforms, creating new channels for inmates to file grievances and slightly improving living conditions in some prisons. But its larger tragic legacy was a hardening of public opinion. For many Americans, the images from Attica solidified the belief that prisoners were violent, dangerous, and beyond saving. This sentiment, ironically, helped fuel the political shift away from any pretense of rehabilitation, paving the way for the even harsher and more punitive tough-on-crime era that was just around the corner. This led to the tough-on-crime era that began in the 1980s and continues to shape the system today. Lawmakers passed policies like mandatory minimum sentencing, three strikes laws, and a war on drugs that caused the prison population in the United States to explode. The focus swung decisively back to punishment and incapacitation. The idea that the main purpose of a prison is to remove dangerous people from society for as long as possible. Rehabilitation programs were often cut, and the prison became, for many, simply a human warehouse. But while many countries were building more and more high-security prisons, a handful of nations, particularly in Scandinavia, were conducting a radical experiment that challenged the very foundations of Western punishment. Instead of asking how to make prisons tougher or more efficient at inflicting suffering, they began asking a different question. What is the ultimate goal of a prison, and how do we best achieve it? They concluded that since over 95% of all inmates will eventually be released, the primary goal of incarceration should be to create good neighbors, not just to punish past crimes. This led to a system built not on retribution, but on rehabilitation, reintegration, and a core principle called normalization. The philosophy is simple but profound. The only punishment a prisoner should face is the loss of their freedom. Everything else, from their living conditions to their daily activities, should be as normal as possible to prepare them for a successful life on the outside. To understand how different this is, you have to look inside their prisons. Even a high-security facility like Halden Prison in Norway, often called the world's most humane prison, looks nothing like its American counterparts. There are no stark, crowded dormitories or long rows of barred cells. Inmates live in units of 10 to 12 private rooms, each with its own bathroom, mini fridge, and flat-screen TV. These units share a modern kitchen and living room, where the inmates are responsible for buying groceries from the prison's shop and cooking their own meals. The prison is filled with green spaces, walking paths, and art on the walls. The architecture is intentionally designed to minimize psychological stress and avoid the cold, institutional feel that defines most prisons. The windows are barless, and the security walls are set far back and hidden by trees. This philosophy extends even further in open prisons, like the famous Bastoy Island. Here, there are no walls at all. Inmates, including those convicted of murder and drug trafficking, live in shared wooden houses, work on the island's farm, manage the stables, and learn trades like mechanics or carpentry. The entire environment is built on trust and responsibility. The key to making this work is the prison staff. The guards are referred to as contact officers, and their role is a hybrid of social worker, mentor, and security guard. They receive years of training in psychology, law, and ethics. They don't carry weapons, and they are encouraged to build relationships with the inmates, eating meals with them, playing sports, and talking with them about their future. The idea is that this dynamic de-escalates conflict and turns the staff into role models who can actively guide an inmate's rehabilitation, a process they call dynamic security. This isn't about giving criminals a holiday, it's a calculated, pragmatic strategy for reducing crime. The Scandinavian model holds that if you treat a prisoner like a wild animal for years, locking them in a cage, stripping them of all responsibility, exposing them to constant violence, and severing their ties to society, you can't be surprised when they struggle or re-offend upon release. By providing inmates with education, extensive job training, and therapy for addiction or mental health issues, the system actively prepares them to be productive citizens. It forces them to develop life skills, from managing a budget for groceries to resolving conflicts with their housemates, that are essential for a successful, crime-free life. And the results of this long-term experiment are staggering. In countries like Norway, the recidivism rate, or the rate at which former prisoners are convicted of a new crime within 2 years of release, is around 20%. In the United States, that number is three times higher, at over 60%. While this system is expensive and requires a high degree of social trust, its success poses a profound challenge to the tough-on-crime model. It suggests that true long-term public safety isn't achieved by making prisons as miserable as possible, but by focusing on a disciplined, evidence-based approach to rehabilitation and a radical commitment to human dignity. The massive social and financial costs of the tough-on-crime era, combined with the success of rehabilitation-focused models, have forced a critical question in the 21st century. Does every crime require a cage? The growing consensus is no. In response, a powerful movement has emerged to create and expand alternatives to incarceration. These are not get-out-of-jail-free cards, but a range of smart, evidence-based programs designed to hold offenders accountable, address the root causes of their behavior, and repair the harm they've caused, all without the destructive and expensive process of imprisonment. One of the most successful alternatives has been the rise of specialized or problem-solving courts. These courts recognize that many crimes are not the result of a rational choice, but are symptoms of a deeper issue, like drug addiction, mental illness, or trauma. The most well-known example is the drug court. In this model, a non-violent offender who has been arrested for a drug-related crime can be diverted into a long-term court-supervised treatment program. Instead of just being sent to a cell, they must attend counseling, submit to regular drug tests, and appear frequently before a judge who acts less like an adversary and more like a coach. Offering encouragement for progress and sanctions for relapses, the goal is to break the cycle of addiction that fuels the crime, which has proven to be far more effective at preventing re-offense than a simple prison sentence. This model has been so successful that it has been adapted for other specific populations, leading to mental health courts and veterans courts. Another powerful alternative shifts the focus from punishment to healing. This is known as restorative justice. Instead of asking what law was broken and who should be punished, restorative justice asks what harm was done and how it can be repaired. The most common form of this is a victim-offender conference. In this process, the offender and the victim, who participates completely voluntarily, are brought together in a safe, moderated meeting, often with community members present. This gives the victim a powerful voice, allowing them to explain the real human impact of the crime and ask questions that the traditional court process ignores. For the offender, it forces them to confront the personal harm they caused, fostering empathy and accountability in a way that a prison sentence rarely can. Together, the group often comes to a consensus on how the offender can work to repair the harm, whether through financial restitution, community service, or other forms of restitution service, or other meaningful acts. Beyond these specific programs, there is a wide range of community-based sanctions that offer accountability without confinement. These include modern forms of probation that are less about simple surveillance and more about actively helping an individual find stable housing and employment. Electronic monitoring, often through an ankle bracelet, allows for home confinement or strict curfews, which is a significant restriction of liberty that is still far less disruptive and costly than jail. And community service provides a direct and visible way for an offender to pay their debt back to the society they harmed. All of these tools are based on a simple premise, that public safety is often better served by keeping non-violent offenders connected to their families and communities, where they can work, pay taxes, and actively address their problems, rather than sending them into an isolating and often crime-hardening prison environment. The push for these alternatives is not just based on a philosophical belief in second chances, it's also driven by pragmatic, data-driven results. In almost every case, these programs are dramatically cheaper than incarceration. For example, a year of intensive supervised probation and treatment can cost a few thousand dollars, while a single year in prison can cost upwards of $40,000 or more, depending on the state. Furthermore, study after study has shown that for many types of offenses, these alternatives are significantly more effective at reducing recidivism. By addressing the root causes of crime, addiction, poverty, mental illness, instead of just punishing the symptoms, they offer a smarter, cheaper, and more humane path forward in the long evolving story of justice. So, from the public square to the solitary cell, the story of the prison is a story of shifting ideas. It was born from a humane desire to end the brutal physical punishments of the past, fueled by an optimistic belief in the power of reason and reflection to reform the human soul. It was shaped by economic pressures that turned workshops into factories, and later by scientific theories that tried to cure crime like a disease. Today, the modern prison remains a place of deep contradictions, caught in a constant debate between its competing goals of punishment, public safety, and the still elusive promise of rehabilitation. It is a direct reflection of our own evolving and often conflicting ideas about the very nature of justice.